Okay, there we go. Finally, after a little bit of technical issues on my part. But I'm here today with Freddie and Susie from UKBP, UK Bitcoin Policy. I'm really excited about this. So,
Or
how are you
Bitcoin
two?
Policy UK. Are you both frozen?
I was just being very still.
Oh, well.
Cool. Did you answer? I'm not sure. My internet just went a little bit bad.
Are you calling from the middle of the
Oh.
ocean or something, Harley?
I don't know. Can you hear me? Oh God.
I
Is that
was
any
just
better?
very still.
Is that better? Have I fixed it? Maybe.
We can hear you now.
I can
No,
hear you and I
still.
can see you.
Okay, cool. Perfect. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah, how are you two?
Great.
Good.
Hungover. Exhausted.
Hungover. Great. This is gonna be fun. Okay. Yeah. So just for everyone listening who might not know you, what were you two doing before you started UK Bitcoin Policy, and what's some inspiration behind why you started it in the first place?
I think Freddie should go first because he actually asked me to join.
I
I forget that, Susie. We were originally inspired probably by two things, I think. Firstly, what the BPI do in the US, and secondly, by Jordan Walker and Jim Duffy's Edinburgh Bitcoin conference, which I think is where Susie was at as well. I'll let her tell her own story. For anyone who wasn't at that conference, it was a really special event, and I think a lot of UK Bitcoiners left that feeling quite inspired. I'd already been doing a degree of outreach and communication in my previous job, which was at a fintech firm. And as part of that, it became clear that while there was a lot of crypto noise in the UK market, there wasn't really anybody doing the same job specifically for Bitcoin. So an awful lot of altcoin companies, of Web3 companies, have been lobbying very hard and trying to get favorable regulation put in place for their own products. And obviously, because Bitcoin is a decentralized and doesn't have a CEO or anything comparable to a company, no one was doing that job for Bitcoin. And Bitcoin had always been sort of my interest and my focus. And I'd started to write some submissions in response to consultations for Parliament and Treasury and the FCA and so on. And then I sort of left the Edinburgh conference really quite keen to get further involved. And Jordan pulled together a bunch of people who had sort of like-minded ideas. And as part of the process of pulling the team together, we were already fans of Susie's writing. Susie, I think you were still writing City AM at the time, weren't you? I reached out to you right at the beginning, and then maybe that's a good point to hand over to you for your little piece.
Yeah, so I left my job because I was just a fiat mining, but once you start learning about Bitcoin and you become obsessed with it, everything changes and then you start seeing everything that you're doing is largely meaningless. And it's a really difficult position to be in when you know that you don't want to do it, but you know that you've got to earn money. So unfortunately, when I had babies, I had to go part time and take a demotion. But that meant that it almost killed my career. So I did what I did. I wasn't working in Marks and Spencer's, which was good. But at the same time, I didn't really have any kind of career progression. So rather than progressing, it just kind of went downhill. So at the end of my career, not being able to find a part-time job, I'd get called by recruitment agents all the time. And then as soon as I told them that I wanted to be part-time, they'd almost put the phone down on me. So it was really difficult. And because I knew that I wanted to work in Bitcoin, but I didn't know what to do because there were no Bitcoin jobs available really, I knew that I had to carve something out for myself. So I begged my boss to make me redundant. almost every single day for about a year. And eventually he caved, gave me a little lump sum that I needed to be able to then figure it out. And that's when I made space, tried to find my space, started the writing, was writing for City AM, wrote the article, how Bitcoin could help save the environment. In fact, you can see the pictures back here from that article. I don't know if you can actually see them. These two.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
And then, they're really cool. And then Freddie obviously read it, reached out to me, asked me if I wanted to join as the head of mining, and the rest is history.
Wow. That's like the ultimate Bitcoiner's dilemma, right? Wanting to work in Bitcoin, but having no idea what any Bitcoin jobs are.
Yeah, so you got to make it, haven't you? Yeah, which is what we did.
Mm-hmm. Nice. And you touched on it a little bit, Freddie, but do you want to explain the main goals and what you focus on at Bitcoin Policy UK?
Sure. We perhaps with a sort of bird's eye view, we have sort of several different silos within the team. Some focus on mining and the environment, some on education, and a big piece on policy. The reason, obviously, we've got such a keen focus on policy is that although a lot of us and a lot of Bitcoiners particularly would prefer that the government simply just left us alone, I'm afraid we have to acknowledge that we live in the real world and people do still need to buy houses or travel or use bank accounts. And so long as that remains true, the government is effectively a gatekeeper that sits at the intersection between the traditional world and the Bitcoin world. While it's completely correct that you can transact peer-to-peer and remove yourself as much as you can from the existing financial system, if, for example, you wanted to go out and buy a house using some of your Bitcoin stack, you would find it extremely difficult to do so because you'd need to prove source of funds and so on. A lot of banks, and you know, exploring this as an example for why we do what we do, a lot of banks to this day will not allow you to use any money that has resulted from cryptocurrency sales in order to put down money for a house deposit, which is a bit of a problem. And that's exactly the kind of thing that we want to try and solve. So some of the reasons for this attitude are many, and a lot of it is to do with the incorrect preconception that all Bitcoin and cryptocurrency money is related to crime, and banks are obviously terrified of being fined for having facilitated money laundering, bluntly. Mm-hmm. So if you turn up at a bank with 100k in sterling that you say you have got from selling Bitcoin that you bought in, I don't know, 2014 or something like that, they're likely to refuse to let you use that money to buy your house. That kind of misunderstanding is really what we want to try and change, and we want to give as much good information about what Bitcoin is, how it works, and how to use it to the government, to regulators, to the traditional financial system, to enable those kind of transactions to take place, bluntly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I think that's probably something a lot of people overlook, especially myself. And now, obviously, it's nice to yell, no regulation, no regulation, but they kind of control everything at this point, so you have to concede at some point. But yeah, what about...
And this, actually, I wondered if you saw the tweet on Twitter yesterday.
Did you see that?
Oh, you didn't see that. Oh, okay.
Yeah,
what was it? This exact subject came up. Yeah, someone was just saying that we agree with the FCA making it difficult. Everybody should be buying peer-to-peer. It's just a very naive view. But the thing is when you're advocating for things like this, people think that you want the government to get involved. Yeah. And I don't. I'm not even a fan of institutional adoption. I just recognise that it's part of the process.
Yeah, 100%. And do you find your approach for different for when you're considering mining? I imagine it's a little bit more wanting to be involved with the government when it comes to the wasted wind energy.
Because they're the ones that implement rules that allow wind farms to switch off. So they pay for the curtailment, and while they're paying for curtailment, they've got no incentive to mine Bitcoin because their problem has been solved. So there are instances where they have to get involved.
It's probably worth unpacking that for some of your listeners who aren't aware of how the funds flow works. So Susie touched on curtailment there. So curtailment, if your listeners aren't aware, is the process by which wind farms have to turn off, either because they're producing too much power for the grid or simply that there's not enough demand for that power. And when they get turn off, they have to get paid for doing so. Now, the way that the electricity grid operates in the UK, we have several different bodies that oversee it. One is National Grid, one is NESO, which is the National Energy Systems Operator, and there's also Ofgem as well. And those are ultimately all influenced to a greater or lesser degree by government decision-making. And the policy that has been put in place for covering those costs of curtailment is that curtailment costs are added to customers' bills. So one of the reasons that we actually have such astonishingly expensive electricity in this country is because we do have to pay curtailment costs directly to the renewable power providers who are being paid by us to turn off. So we're basically paying for power that even we aren't using simply because of the way that our national grid is structured. Now, as Susie rightly said, there's absolutely no incentive for a wind farm to look into an alternative source of income because at the moment, you know, their life is just full of gravy. Either they're selling power to the grid or they're sitting there twiddling their thumbs while their windmills are stationary and they're just getting paid for it. So there's absolutely no incentive at all for them to look at alternative sources. And that won't change until there's a decision made at government level, at NESO, at the National Grid, to do something about it.
Yeah, and subsidies don't help either when it comes to renewables. Every time governments interfere, they disrupt things. And so subsidies are also a part of that. So although we don't necessarily want the government to get involved because of the decisions that they make, it affects it. So it has to change and they have to understand.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, that they get paid regardless, even for turning off. But if there was some altruistic wind farmer who tried to say this is wrong, and try to implement Bitcoin mines, how do you think that, has there been an attempt and how do you think that might go?
I don't think there are Bitcoiners who work on wind farms that are trying their best. They do exist, but it's very difficult because the incentives are not there. So, you know, with bad incentives, we know where that leads.
And also it's one thing to talk about altruism and it's another actually to look at your economic model for running your business. Most businesses are not altruistic, and that's absolutely fine. You know, the job of you and you know your fiduciary duty as a director is to make money, unless you are acting specifically for a not-for-profit. And if you're not making money, then ultimately your company will go bust. So it's one thing to hope that a business model might work, and it's not. I think this is something a lot of Bitcoiners forget. You know, when no one's running a charity, although Susie and I ironically work for a not-for-profit and we don't get paid for this work, so maybe I'm talking rubbish, but you know, the majority of commercial enterprises need to make money, and at the moment it doesn't economically make sense to mine in front of the meter in the UK because our electricity costs are too high and bad incentives and bad regulations make it very difficult to mine behind the meter. Because you know, planning is another example that I mentioned in a meeting that Susie and I had this week. You might well need, if you're a wind farm, to get a planning application for a change of use or a mixed use for co-locating miners with your wind farm. And no one wants to take the risk that their planning application is turned down or denied. Again, why make the effort when they're getting paid anyway?
And also CapEx costs, depending on where you do it. So, for example, mining off a landfill and methane is a possibility and can happen. And we've got landfills everywhere, all over the UK. But the CapEx costs can sometimes take 2 or 3 years to pay back. And that's, you know, then you'd have to have a Bitcoiner on the inside that would want to take that risk. Otherwise, they just flare it.
Yeah. Can you explain what CapEx is? Just for anyone that doesn't know.
So the capital cost of the machinery that is required to actually turn the methane into electricity and then mine from that. So that there'd be a lot of equipment and setup costs. And that is not cheap. So to get the money back that you put up front would take 2 or 3 years, and that can also be a barrier.
Yeah, of course. And has there been much difference since you started in how you approach government officials and how you contact them? And what's been the most effective that you've tried, really?
Reasonable amount of progress, actually. I mean, obviously we started effectively from a standing start. So we set up almost exactly 2 years ago, didn't we, Susie? April 2023. And to begin with, we were very much on the back foot. We spent a lot of time during these past 2 years making as many connections as we can, both in Parliament and in the industry, and also allying where we were appropriate with those who may share some but not all of our views. And I think it's fair to say that we've made slow but steady progress. We've written a lot of material which we've sent, we've submitted in consultation responses to the Bank of England, to the FCA, to HMRC, to Treasury, to Parliament. So there's a considerable body of work that we've produced, which is now in front of these people. Possibly the most effective way that we've actually found of getting directly into relevant departments is actually by writing open letters. So we've written a number of open letters on specific issues such as debanking, the removal of the ability to pay cryptocurrency firms with Chase bank account, for example, highlighting the fact that the UK holds a lot of Bitcoin and it needs to act responsibly given that it has such a large stack, flagging daft differences in regulation between the UK and the US, where US citizens are allowed to hold ETFs and we're not. I tend to side with Susie here. I'm much more of a self-custody fan
Of course, yeah.
than an ETF fan. But at the same time, we live in the real world. Some people want to hold ETFs, and if you believe in a market-driven economy and you're a free market maximalist, you have to allow people to spend the money how they want. Some people want to buy ETFs, fair enough. I personally don't, but it's clear that there's a market for them, and that market is being poorly served by the UK. And so, in writing these open letters, we'll write them directly to the relevant ministers, and we've got a good track record of getting actual responses from ministers, and then also having our policy documents that we give to them put in front of the relevant policy teams. So I'd say it's baby steps, and the UK, as you know, is a particularly backward jurisdiction for trying to get people to understand these things. But the change of regime in the US is probably quite helpful for us.
But also
Nice.
talking to people
And
directly. So Freddie and I have actually spoken to two politicians, or a politician and their researcher. And when you speak to people directly, you find out that everything that they think they knew about Bitcoin is not right. It's the classic, it's boiling the oceans. It's a Ponzi scheme. It's got no value. All of these things. And when you actually talk to people directly, even for 5 minutes, and you explain it to them, they do have those light bulb moments. So the letters that Freddie writes are fantastic, and the responses, the fact that they respond is also great. But actually speaking to people and explaining it to them one on one, I found over the past couple of weeks has actually had incredible results, and not necessarily open doors, but made people more open-minded, so that we now have access to people that we wouldn't have had before.
Yeah,
Yeah,
I agree with that.
pharmacies.
And part of the strategy there is that you create touch points with people, and when the issue comes up, they'll say, "Oh, okay, I've got Susie's number. I'll give her a call, or I can reach out to Freddie." It's establishing reputation and body of work, and being the person that people call when they want to try and formulate policy in this area.
And does that differ when you try to consider mining? Because, I mean, like we've already been over, you'd imagine that it'll be a no-brainer for government, but clearly it is. I mean, do you take a different approach when you're going towards mining? Because that is more obvious that
Mining.
it's better for the government rather than policy, financial policy.
So mining to help renewables is one thing, and then home mining is another, and mining with businesses is also another consideration. So Freddie alluded to it earlier. It has to make business sense. otherwise it's just not going to work. And we've identified lots of opportunities where big factories have, say, solar panels, and they use their solar during the day, but then in the evening or in the weekends, they don't have a use for it. So we've actually got some S19s. I think Russ has taken some down to a factory today, actually. I think he's taking four S19s down to somewhere, and they're going to actually start mining from their excess solar. So it's free money. And once we can get case studies for that and write it up, we can show that they make business sense. And that will then extend into, have you ever heard of an EPC? It's an energy performance certificate, I think it's called. Every single commercial building, and I think that every building has to have one, and it measures the efficiency of your home or your building or anything like that. If we can start incorporating Bitcoin mining into things like that, it will actually improve the efficiency of buildings. So then once you've got all these use cases and you can show the benefits, then you can tackle it from a business point of view and show that it does actually make business sense.
Yeah.
It just takes time, though. That's the problem.
Yeah, you've got to
get over the hump. Like, you know how I feel about the mainstream media, and the damage that has done. We've not only got to prove that it actually makes business sense, we've got to convince them that Bitcoin isn't evil to start with. Because as soon as you say that, the shutters come down. So there's lots of barriers. It's all about education and talking.
Well, you know the Max Planck quote on that. A new idea does not triumph by convincing those who disagree with it. It's because the old people die off and they're replaced by new people who already get it.
Yeah, it's a good
one. It's a shame, though, isn't it? I don't want to wait that long.
I mean, they are. It's probably unethical to suggest encouraging them to. You know, my views on boomers.
Maybe we should hope to prove that quote false with Bitcoin. But yeah, but I did read one of your letters to Chase Bank, which quite confused me and put into perspective that there is a very large difference between policy and treatment. Even after you have some policy, I mean, you noted that someone in the government, my brain's gone foggy, but said that they wanted the UK to be a UK crypto hub or something along those lines. And yet Chase continued to openly deny access to any crypto.
Exactly. So the argument, the line of reasoning we took there was that policy change by Chase Bank happened just after Rishi Sunak had come out and said that he wanted the UK to be a crypto hub. It was official government policy in the last parliament. So we were highlighting the discrepancy between government policy and how banks operating in the United Kingdom were behaving, and how absolutely outrageous that is. You've got to remember that banks in the UK are all regulated entities, and they operate under permission, effectively, from the Bank of England and from the government. And for a bank, on the one hand, to be in a jurisdiction that's pretending it's going to be a crypto hub, and at the same time taking action that actively, you know, undermines government policy, as we said in the letter, is just daft.
Yeah, is that
pretending to be a crypto hub? And the thing is that was exactly round about the time that they made it harder as well. So not only did they say that it was like a policy, but they actually went out of their way to make it harder.
So worth unpacking that. So by making it harder, Susie's referring to the extension of the financial promotions regime to advertisements and sales of crypto assets, which unfortunately include Bitcoin. So a lot of our messaging to government and to regulators has been that Bitcoin is a different beast from every other crypto asset and should be considered and treated differently. We've focused recently very much on different risk profiles. So if from an investment perspective, the risk profile of Bitcoin is dramatically lower than that of a meme coin that someone's made in their bedroom at the weekend. But at the moment, our regulation treats all of them in the same bucket. And that's completely idiotic and needs to be changed. And one of the consequences of that risk profile is that because Bitcoin's treated the same as, you know, Squidcoin or whatever, all of those are grouped together and classed as restricted mass market investments. And the rules state that you can't market a restricted mass market investment to the general public without them going through certain questionnaires, which your listeners may have seen when trying to buy Bitcoin on exchanges, and self-categorization as to a high net worth individual or not. And if you're not a high net worth individual, you'll be limited to 10,000. I think it's 10% of your net worth purchases per year. So all of these restrictions are being thrown up in the way of people buying Bitcoin, and all of them stem from that one stupid decision by the regulator.
Yeah. So would you say that the rejection of banks to UK policy is a show that they're not really subject to policy, or that they're being a bit sneaky and that is something that can actually be cracked down upon?
Well, I mean, these things are always much more complicated than they appear on the surface. So you've got to consider what the decision-making process of the bank is. One of the reasons that banks are so wary about this is something called APP fraud. That's authorized push payment fraud. So that would arise where, let's say, Susie authorizes a payment from her bank account to a third party, and that turns out to be fraudulent. Until recently, the banks would have been responsible for making her whole for that APP fraud up to, I think it was about £400,000. So there was considerable risk exposure. Banks tend to be notoriously risk averse, and they wouldn't want to be exposed to the risk of an APP fraud, which happened to be cryptocurrency. Now, the threshold for APP reimbursement has actually recently dropped last year. It came down to, I think, about $85,000. But worth fact-checking me on that. So the risk profile has actually diminished, and it's interesting to consider whether that diminution of risk profile will lead to a more open attitude towards Bitcoin. A second issue is that it's been hard for the banks to work out so far how exactly they can make money from this thing. As soon as they do that, then you're likely to see more and more products coming to market. Unfortunately, the wider adoption of Bitcoin in the UK is so poor that we're seeing those kind of new products be offered in different jurisdictions. An example I often use is Zappo Bank, which is based in Gibraltar. They are very innovative, and they really offer a combination of a traditional US dollar account with Bitcoin also held in custody at the bank. Again, as I mentioned before, we're probably more self-custody focused than otherwise, but now, if you want to hold your Bitcoin in a bank and you want to get, at some point, Bitcoin-backed loans, or buy a house, get a mortgage with the bank, that legitimization of your source of funds is particularly very helpful.
It's definitely also a bridge, right, to go straight from nothing, especially not being very techy to begin with. Especially, again, for my generation, I found it really hard, going straight from nothing to like trying to run a node and trying to get a hardware wallet. Which I was lucky, I got a hardware wallet for Christmas, actually. But, not everyone is that lucky. So it's, I think, a good bridge for a lot of people, maybe younger and older, to go from a bank custodying to...
You've got to start somewhere. So when somebody is interested and they ask me the question, how do I buy it? How do I start answering that question if you can't use exchanges or any kind of traditional methods? It's very difficult. And even when you can use exchanges, it's still tricky, because then you still have to talk about getting it off the exchange. And a lot of people can't understand why everything is so complicated, because the current system is set up to be so convenient. And when you've been sold convenience constantly, jumping through these hoops is not something that people are used to.
Yeah. Yeah, I think,
and because most people do come for number go up, they start with the number go up, and then they do stay for all the other aspects that it offers. But you're not going to get people hooked or understanding it unless they've got skin in the game. And the only way you're going to do that is to make it easy. Unfortunately, it's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm, I agree. Also, you said you started BP UK 2 years ago, and in that time, have you seen any meaningful change in how you're received? I mean, I think in 2 years it's become much more of a legitimized asset, if you say that. And do you think the UK government agreed?
Yeah, I think we're seeing certainly an increase of interest and also an increase in support. Susie, you mentioned two of the meetings we've had recently, with one with the current, one with the next politician. We can't give names because of confidentiality reasons, but I think there's an interesting changing of the, you know, turning of the tide happening. In fact, the messages we had this week, Susie, in relation to that particular MP were extremely encouraging, weren't they?
Very.
The We were explicitly told that this person, who's a reasonably senior politician, actively supports us, keen to get involved, keen to help. That's not something we would have seen 2 years ago. And at least two or three other ex-MPs have given similar messages to us. And I think it's all a good piece of visible evidence is the increasing popularity of the events that we put on. So last week we had the second of our events with Axiom, who are Alan Farrington's venture fund. This was at the Law Society, extremely well attended. We had members of the House of Lords on stage. We had MPs on stage. They want to come to our events. They want to help. And the more far-sighted members of the establishment, I think, are beginning to understand that Bitcoin is real, it's important, and it's not going away. Unfortunately, if I had to put it in one line, the biggest blocker at the moment are the Labour Party, who are really, really hard to reach and so far have, with a couple of exceptions, not been very welcoming at all. But, you know, maybe they see that Bitcoin is a way of fixing the economy, and that's clearly not something they want to do.
Yeah, I think it's
Good for
definitely
growth,
hardest for
and they don't like
politicians.
it, yeah.
Yeah, I think politicians are definitely the ones with the most baggage. I mean, you kind of get into politics under the belief of Keynesian economics. But yeah.
But I think that that's also poor education, though. I think it's just a lack of understanding. Once again, I think if you actually sat down and explained it to them one on one, I think they'd come away understanding it. But if all the information they've received is from mainstream media, of course we're having these barriers.
It's like chicken and egg problem. You need to fix the money, but you can't fix the money because mass media won't tell you what the problem is, and then yeah, endless. But yeah, is it similar in the mining space, in the education space? I mean, we saw Greenwich School, something. There was a school that implemented their money, like the crypto class or something after school.
Is that are
Is
you
that is it
Huxley's?
Greenwich? It might
But
be Huxley. Yes, that's it.
So he does some amazing projects. Yes, he does some incredible stuff. He's even taken one of the S9s that we had and took it into his class and got them to take it apart and plug it in and do all
That's
that
very
kind of stuff.
cool.
He's done some incredible work with his class, and we even had a call with him once, and he's got kind of Bitcoin art in the background, and he's phenomenal. But yeah, no,
Wow.
of course it's education, because my son actually did a talk at school when he was in year 5 or 6, and I was really surprised that they allowed him to do it. Well, they asked them to give a presentation. I promise, I did not force him to do a presentation on Bitcoin. He wanted to. I mean, obviously, I helped him write it, and we went through it and stuff. But they allowed him to do that, and even that shocked me. I thought that was going to be a no.
Yeah, that's definitely, yeah, that's come a long way, I think, with the education. And yeah, and lots of Bitcoiners probably read your work and are screaming, no, we've been over this a little bit, no regulation, no regulation, no regulation. But do you want to just go into a bit more depth on how that is unattainable, if that's even a possibility in the future at some point, and then maybe how long it's going to take to get there and how much it needs to be
Well, it's important to unpack what it
redone.
is that they're saying. The message, our message consistently to politicians and regulators has been that you cannot regulate Bitcoin because it is a protocol that runs on the internet, that and trying to regulate it is like trying to regulate mathematics. So I'd agree with people who say that no regulation of Bitcoin is possible. Bitcoin is a self-regulating mechanism that exists independently of everyone else, in the same way that mathematics exists independently of people. So our message to the regulators has always been, you can regulate people and you can regulate companies, but you can't regulate Bitcoin because it regulates itself. It's simply a protocol that exists and runs on the internet, and it has certain properties, and these are those properties. So however, people saying no regulation, are being a little bit short-sighted because unfortunately we live in a world where regulation exists and people are trying to create new regulation. So for example, if you have a bank account, if you ever use fiat currency, if you live in a house and pay council tax, you are subject to regulation. If you ever want to buy property, but you know, whether that's buy a house, if you want to I'd put a deposit down for a flat or even a rental deposit. Unfortunately, your bank requires you to be able to show where that money comes from. And at the point I made at the beginning of the pod, banks are very worried about source of funds. They're terrified about AML compliance. You need to be able to demonstrate where you have got your money from, and that's an unfortunate reality. So when people are saying no regulation, no regulation, what exactly are they talking about? Are they saying maybe they would agree with me that Bitcoin isn't capable of regulation? That doesn't mean that your bank's not going to stop you from transferring money to a cryptocurrency exchange to buy Bitcoin. That's the kind of thing that we want to fix. So if someone's saying no regulation, no regulation, knock yourself out, mate. Good luck with continuing to buy your Bitcoin, and very best of luck when you try to buy Bitcoin using your fiat and your bank stops your payment. The reason that payment's been stopped is because we haven't finished our work yet. So I get a bit pissed off with people who say those kind of things, to be honest.
And obviously that the goal is to try and minimize the government's role totally as much as possible, really. Do you see the best strategy being lobbying and trying to reduce their involvement, or do you see it more as orange pilling a lot of people so that we can have little emergent markets, maybe small ones to begin with, that could then grow, or do we kind of have to go through the government?
I think it's very important to recognize that if we live in a world where Bitcoin is going to be successful, which we all believe, then governments are inevitably going to get interested in it. And again, we live in the real world. We don't live in some fantasy LARPer world where we're all going to be, wearing skins and only ever transacting in Bitcoin. I'm not going to live to see that world. It's possible. I mean, the trend for fiat currencies is for them to collapse, for them to trend towards zero, but it usually takes a very long time for that to happen, and then you get a sudden period of currency destruction. If Bitcoin is successful, then we're going to live in a world where everyone's going to want exposure to it, and everyone will use it in different ways. And again, if you're a proper libertarian, you should be of the view that everyone is free to behave it in the way that they choose to behave. And it's not my job to tell you how to live your life or how to use your money. I mean, ideally, I'd like the government to get out of the way, but I recognize that it's not in the nature of governments to do that. So we need to do what we can to minimize the negative effect of governments and bad regulation, bluntly.
Do you think that our currency will collapse in our lifetime?
It's possible. I mean,
I mean, it
how much
depends.
longer have we
We
got to
need, but
live?
I
Another
think it
40
would
years?
definitely. Yeah, I think you can definitely
Because
say it
I
collapse,
foresee
but
it
I think
happening in the
collapse is
next
different
5 to
to
10.
disappearing. Yeah. I just think a
I
collapse is
think it
different to
could happen very
disappearance.
quickly.
Yeah. But then how ready is Bitcoin for an entire
It's
country to
not.
suddenly adopt? Yeah. That
No.
would be an
I'm
interesting
not
one.
suggesting that it is. Because the two aren't really connected. A currency collapse is not connected to Bitcoin being ready necessarily. But I can
Oh
just see it
yeah.
happening.
Well, what tends to happen isn't that that currency completely vanishes. It's that the old currency is replaced by a new one. Two best examples I know are Weimar Germany, when they went through, I think, three or four different versions of the Reichsmark during the hyperinflation there. And actually, in Zimbabwe, I've lost count of the number of different dollars that have been launched there. The latest one is the ZiG, which was pegged to gold. Before that, we had agro checks. Prior to that, there were at least two iterations of the Zimbabwe dollar. Each of them have collapsed. But again, no country that can issue its own currency will voluntarily stop doing that. It's only pushed to do that by extreme circumstances. And even once a currency does collapse, what tends to happen is the government simply creates a replacement.
I think the dynamic has
So
shifted a bit now. I mean, they can make a replacement, but again, in Weimar Germany, they didn't have the option to swap. So it makes you wonder maybe if they had an alternative. Obviously, they didn't, but like, it's going to be. I think it'll be a
Yeah,
different dynamic, slightly different dynamic at least now.
I mean,
But
I
we'll
can,
see.
in my medium-term prediction, I guess that we might see a hybrid world where you have, rapidly melting fiat currencies and Bitcoin, and when you need to to buy things in your deflating, in your collapsing currency, you quickly peg out of Bitcoin into your collapsing currency, spend it, and then you know, get your groceries, and then you peg back into Bitcoin, which retains its value. So at the moment, Bitcoin probably is capable of performing that function. And as Susie said, Lightning and eCash are options that are in the early stages of enabling it to act as a means of payment for a larger number of people.
I don't think it could help everybody now, though.
Which not yet. Unfortunately. Well, I mean, we know that the base layer can't cope with, I forget the number of people, but there's a certain maximum number of people who could ever transact on the base layer.
But even Lightning isn't ready, or far from it. I mean, some people think that Lightning isn't good at all. I mean, I'm really surprised when I speak to some people that have no time for Lightning, which I find baffling. But,
But you know, interesting. It's important to understand that you can look at what has worked in the existing banking system and transpose that into a Bitcoin world. And I always encourage people to go back to Hal Finney and read his long post on Bitcoin banks. Susie, you and I talked about this when we spoke at the IEA, the idea that we might revert to effectively a free banking world where banks hold Bitcoin and they issue their own notes or electronic currency backed by that Bitcoin. And then they can transact freely between themselves. And then they can perform base layer settlements in much the same way as banks, commercial banks, settle between themselves at end of day at the moment. It's a really good post by Hal and well worth reading from someone extraordinarily far-sighted in 2010, I think it was.
Yeah, that's really good. And we have just hit 10:30, so I don't want to keep you any longer. But thank you very much, you two. I really appreciate the time and for putting up with a little problems at the start, but thank you very much. It's been really fun.
Thank you for having us on. Appreciate
it. Thanks, Harley.
Take care.
Cheers.
Thanks. Cheers.